is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's 4:47 p.m. on February 12th, and we're going to start the student assembly meeting for today. First, just to reiterate what Matt Battaglia over there said, if you would like to be on the speaker's list either for the resolution that opposes the health fee, or you would like to be on the list of students who can ask a Q&A, ask a question during the Q&A with Susan Murphy, you can also sign up over there at any time, and we'll follow the order on the list, except for we might modify it so that student assembly members get less preferential treatment. And I will explain that as we move on in the meeting. Before we get started, we do have to take attendance of student assembly members. Chelsea, when you have a moment, can you please call the roll?
Thank you.
It should work. I don't know if it is.
And guys, just speak up when you should talk.
Always on?
Unaccused.
Bacharach?
Here.
Salik? Here. Batista?
Excuse.
Zandari? Brown?
Here.
Chack?
Here.
Fridman?
Excuse.
Goldman?
Here.
Henderson?
Here.
Johnston?
Here.
Kaufman?
Here.
LaPointe?
Here.
Lee?
Unaccused.
Aaron Liu? Lisa Liu?
Here.
Masson?
Here.
Stelig?
Here.
Stefanko?
Excuse.
Sullivan?
Here.
Kyle?
Excuse.
Tidcombe?
Here.
Vakili?
Excuse.
Warshaw? Yang?
Here.
Zhao?
Here.
How many people? So for those of you who just walked in, we have a speakers list in the back if you would like to talk regarding the resolution that opposes the health fee, or if you would like to ask a question to Susan Murphy later in the meeting. So feel free to sign up over there at any time.
18.
There are 18 members present today. Next, we'll do an approval of the January 29th and February 5th meeting minutes.
Motion to approve.
There's been a motion to approve. Is there a second? If there is no dissent, I will ask that we approve these by unanimous consent. Seeing no dissent, the minutes are approved in the past 2 weeks.
And so in lieu of our normal short open microphone at the beginning of the meeting, we're going to be doing an extended open microphone after the forum with VP Murphy, and it'll be moderated by the Cornell Forensic Society. And so that'll be a chance to speak about like any concerns related to shared governance, financial transparency as a whole, and anything else that's on the agenda. So please, thank you for coming, and please stay after the forum for the open mic.
So if you guys are curious about what our agenda is today and you didn't pick one up in the front of the room, we do have it up on that screen. The first thing that we are going to go to on our agenda is announcements and reports. The first one is by our Director of Elections, Aniket, and he can come up here to announce.
Thank you. I'm pleased to announce the schedule for the Spring 2015 Student Assembly elections. The deadline for election registration is February 27. Thanks to the efforts of the Office of the Assembly, we are now rolling out an online registration system. The registration has to be completed online, while petitions must be submitted in person to 109 Day Hall. Voting will take place on March 16 and 17, and we are going to try our best to declare the results before the spring break. At the same time, I would like to strike a note of caution and direct potential candidates to our election rules on early campaigning and coordinating among candidates. In case of any violation of rules reported to us, the Elections Committee will take action.
All right, thank you so much, Kushagra. Now we're going to move straight into new business. Before we can move into anything regarding the health fee, today the Student Assembly is going to approve or recommend several options to to the registrar regarding the final exam schedule. Because this is technically a recommendation, if anyone in the audience would like to comment or ask a question about the final exam scheduling process, feel free to let me know at any time, and I will write you down on a speaker's list up here, not back there. And with that, VP Henderson gets 4 minutes to introduce.
Yeah, we'll try to go quickly with this because I think most people are here for non-final exam related things. But so this is Resolution 45, and for every semester, the registrar, before they release the official final exam schedule, they present three different scenarios which are shown on the projector to the right of me. And so essentially, there's a couple different ways that they can weigh the different scenarios. One is mainly based on front-loading large classes and trying to make sure as many people as possible finish their schedule early in the final exam week. And so that would be scenario two, where large exams are kind of pushed up to the front of the schedule. And then another example is scenario three, which mainly tries to avoid exams that come very close to each other for certain students. So like if you look at the different metrics of three exams in one day, back-to-back exams, those are the metrics that scenario three tries to minimize. And so in this resolution, kind of similar to last year, we're advocating for scenario three, which minimizes three exams in one day, three exams in 24 hours, and also minimizing back-to-back exams. And I think the rationale for focusing on the bottom three metrics is that direct time conflicts are usually things that professors are open to addressing, because I think if you go to a professor and say that there's a direct time conflict, I don't think both of them will ask you to drop the class and be like refuse to change the schedule. And so it's really the bottom three metrics of spacing out exams for like any one given student that we're trying to minimize, which is the rationale for scenario three, which is what we propose in this resolution. And so if anyone has any questions, I guess about the process or anything else like that, I'm happy to answer them. That's pretty much it.
And just to clarify, we do have to vote on this today before we can move into anything regarding the healthy, because our deadline to the registrar is this weekend. Mm. So we do have to let her know which scenario the students think is best. Would anyone like to speak? Franklin?
I think the only difference is like if your first one is at the end of the day and then you have two more in the morning of the next day. It's like pretty much the same thing. One metric is for like three in one day, like three in one date, and the other one is like three within a 24-hour time span. They're essentially the same thing. And scenario three, if you look at the numbers, does minimize like all of those bad cases, which like I think a policy that focuses on mental health should try to minimize the lower three rows.
Are there any other questions or comments from anyone in the audience, or perhaps a motion on the floor? So technically we need to move it to business of the day first. Are you okay with that? Okay. So that was a motion to move it to business of the day?
Second.
It's been seconded. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will move this to business of the day. Now if anyone would like to motion to vote, we can do that. There's been a motion to vote. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will take a vote on this, but Jordan is first going to explain how we get to vote. Everyone in the audience gets to vote.
Regarding the proposed final exam schedule as a recommendation, it will require a majority vote of SA members present to pass. Two community votes will also be allocated to the side with the majority vote.
So first, we're going to start with the community vote. So basically, anyone in the audience, or in this room right now who is not a member of the Student Assembly, can vote. Your options are yes, no, or abstain. And basically, whatever the majority of your votes are, we will add two votes to our total votes for Student Assembly members. Does that make sense? So, if the people in this room who are not on the Student Assembly are in favor of this resolution as it stands, please raise your hand.
three, four, five, six, okay, seven, eight, nine, ten. Is everyone's hands up? All right, we got ten. Raise your hand if you're opposed. All right, and raise your hand if you'd like to abstain.
One, two, three.
Just so you guys know, if there's more abstains than yes votes, then it fails, but that's a minor rule. If you want to abstain, you can. Okay, so I got four abstains. So by a vote of 10 to 0 to 4, there will be two yes votes going towards our total. And now we'll move on to the student assembly members. We have 19 student assembly members here today. If you are in favor of this resolution, please raise your placard. If you're opposed, and if you'd like to abstain. So by a total vote of 20 to 0 to 0, this motion passes. Thank you guys so much for your patience. And now, because Susan Murphy is here, if she is ready, we could go straight into the Q&A. Would that be all right with you? Before we move into the Q&A, I'm going to maybe describe a little bit how it'll work. Essentially, we're going to postpone the discussion of the healthy resolution until the end of the meeting after the open microphone so that we can be considerate of Susan's time here with us. In the event that we run out of time after the forum, we will definitely address Resolution 46, opposing the health fee, next week. And other than that, I'm going to introduce Nick and Jen, who are from the Cornell Forensic Society, who will be moderating the forum part of today, and they're also going to explain how speaking is going to work.
I just want to thank everyone for coming. I want to thank Susan Murphy for coming.
Oh, is this off?
You just need to get close. You have to get really close to these, otherwise you can't hear.
Hello?
That's better. That's right up in your voice.
Okay. I want to thank everyone for coming, not only people from the student community, from the SA, and also student Susan Murphy. Nick and I are from the Cornell Forensic Society, which is a debate team on campus. Our function here is to be an independent third party and hopefully to moderate a productive discussion among students who want to know more about and move forward with the healthy and discussions around the recent healthy. What we're going to do is first we're going to introduce questions that were submitted previously online. While this is happening, Matt Henderson is going to be passing around a paper. If you would like to ask a question after the previously submitted questions have been asked, please add your name on there. We want to emphasize that there's going to be no favoritism on this list. It's literally going to be who puts their name on first. So please, we encourage the people who want to know more after these questions have been asked to do so. And keep in mind the comments and questions should be appropriate to the topic. They should be related to the fee, and they should lead to a hopefully productive discussion.
Okay, so we'll get started with questions that were submitted ahead of time. The format for questions, if you are here and indicated that you wish to read the question yourself, will be 1 minute for your question or your comment. We'll either call your name or read the question ourselves. After this section and after VP Murphy leaves, there will be an open microphone discussion, which will continue the forum. We will also moderate that, and the speakers list for that will be passed out later, or I believe it's at the back of the room now.
Yeah, both of the speakers lists are actually there now. Anyone who'd like to sign up, you can get up at any time and write your name on the
Okay, I can ask first. So the first question is from Alex Klein. Is Alex Klein here? Okay, you can come up and ask the question, or you can go ask from there, whichever.
I was just hoping you could explain in more detail exactly what the financial breakdown of the fee goes to. So how much money is going to the net, how much money goes to the net expansion, how much money goes to the future debt, and if you can't get that information offhand, is there a place you can reach an access to that?
I will try to cover as much as I can, and if it's not sufficient, we'll try to continue from there. So there's a $350 fee that is the health fee. $150 of that is targeted to what we are calling expansion of services for those students who are paying the fee. And what I mean by that, as you will see on a chart that's been posted online, students who now are not on our health insurance end up having to pay for services as they go, what we call fee for service. There are a number of those services, and I will read just a partial list, that now will be covered in a prepayment form for students. So when they visit, all they will do is pay a $10 copay, the same way our students on the health insurance. For example, something I know well, physical therapy will now be covered as part of the health fee, and all students that would pay would be a $10 copay instead of the charge of the fee. Preventive visits, medical procedures, medical supplies connected to visits. So I have a leg brace on my leg. If I were on private insurance, I have to pay for that brace. If I'm on student health insurance, that's covered as part of my premium. Now it will be covered as part of the health fee. X-ray, in-house lab tests, sexually transmitted infection screening. Those are some examples of things that students on health insurance, besides ours, pay as a fee for service. It will now be covered as part of the fee. That's $150 of the $350 fee, so an expansion of services. And that's really towards the staffing who are providing that those services. The $200 is to pay for two parts, really. One is the staffing we put in place when we expanded our services after 2009 and 2010 as a result of two key public health crises, our H1N1 and our suicide cluster. And if I can put my hands out, I can tell you exactly how much in recent years, to meet the demand of students, we have added 5.6 full-time equivalents of mental health providers, almost 3 medical clinicians, and over 7 full-time equivalent of nurses. So this was an expansion of staffing that was needed to meet the demand of students. We had one-time funding for 3 years to pay for that. We did not have a permanent source of funding to backfill. I was unwilling to fire the staff and therefore cut back on the services. So we borrowed the funding to cover those costs. So $200 of the fee is to help cover that shortfall of funding, some of which is paying back the loan that we took out for 2 years to maintain our level of service. And that number, Alex, is approximately $70 out of that $200. Students who are on the student health insurance premium will also have some part of the fee that they pay next year as part of their student health insurance premium also going to pay for that expansion of service and repayment of debt. So it's not we're treating those on the fee differently than the health insurance. It's just that the student on health insurance are already paying a fee that helps to cover that. None of the fee, and none of the health insurance, but none of the fees particularly, is going to the creation of the expansion. That has been funded by gifts, by contributions from the colleges, and by contributions out of the administrative unit, the largest of which came out of our division in student and academic services.
All right, thank you. The next question is from Daniel Gary. Daniel, if you're here.
Then you can ask.
Okay, so Daniel's question was,
As an educational institution, where does Cornell's responsibility to students' health begin and end? Is it truly the responsibility of an educational institution to provide students with health insurance, much less force it upon them? Does it not seem that the relationship between a student and university should be more business customer oriented? Things such as gym passes, meal plans, housing are all semi-privatized and not forced upon us. Why is health insurance?
So this is an excellent and very complicated question. The policy about every student having health insurance was passed by our Board of Trustees, 20 or 30 years ago. So that is not a new policy. It's why when a student enrolls, we automatically bill you for the Cornell University health insurance, and you have to go through a conscious decision to waive that insurance because it's a mandate. The reason for that is because we are a community that lives, eats, and breathes together, quite frankly. You know, it might be a very different policy if we were an institution distributed across an urban setting without providing any residential experiences and our students came and went a couple hours here, a couple hours there. But that's not who we are. And so we take as a responsibility, if you will, an obligation to worry about the public health of our community as well as the individual health of students. And the reason for that is health crises have a public impact. So let's take 2009-2010 to just be the most dramatic example. We had 1,500 cases of diagnosed H1N1. The CDC said we probably had 3,000 students on the campus who had H1N1, one of the largest infestations, if you will, in the United States. That took enormous resources of our health clinic, not just to treat the students who walked in the door who needed to be treated, but to have a health campaign, to work with environmental health and safety, to get Purell all over the campus, to educate people about how to stay healthy and avoid the flu. And similarly, any of you who had friends who have had mental health crises know, or alcohol crises, or drug crises, know the toll that that can take on you as their friend or roommate or your community. And so having the resources to deal with the public health is just as important as the individual health, and that's where some of these resources are going.
The next question is one that many students asked. I'm going to recognize all the students who asked it, but I'm going to give preference to the first student who asked it, and if that student is not here, I'll go down the list. So on the topic of low-income students and people who demonstrate economic need, we had questions from Jeremy Candelas, Emily Kay, Matt Harkins, Alex Klein, Ilsa Paniagua, Allison, James Knight, Caro Akar, Aditi Bomek, and Cheryl Millian. The first person who asked the question was Jeremy. Is Jeremy here? Is Emily Kay here? Is Matt Harkins here? Okay.
My question was, I'm on private insurance. I received heavy financial aid from the university, which I'm very appreciative of. And I've only been to Gannett once, mostly because I don't have time to get sick. But I'm wondering, and that's what President Scort considers the outlier population, students who will be ultimately hurt by this. I'm wondering what my options are because I can't figure out how to pay for $350.
So, in your particular case, the most direct option would be to seek an additional loan from Gannett. We do not have the grant aid available to cover. We don't cover any of our. There's a very small population at Cornell that gets some grant assistance for their health insurance. One population is the students in New York State who are on Medicaid. The state is actually buying our health insurance for some number of them, but it's actually cheaper for the state to buy our student health insurance than to give them the New York State Medicaid. And our students who are opportunity program students, the state funded educational opportunity, higher educational opportunity. Those students, and I'm talking to undergraduates, those students do get some support for their medical. Everybody else, whether they're on financial aid or not, on the student health insurance or not, are using either their family resources or what's in their financial aid package. Now, in your financial aid package is an allowance for, you know, so it's tuition. What covers it? What does financial aid cover? Tuition, the student activity fee, that's the one required fee we have, room, board, books, travel, and personal expenses. So in that allowance of personal expenses, some students may make some trade-off, I'm not going to use it for X, I'm going to use it for this. So there is some allowance. I don't want to overstate that because, I actually don't know what that total amount is. I know it's in excess of $12,000. So there may be some in your financial aid if you're not using all that personal expense allowance or what's covered, or what's allowed for your travel. You may have funding in your financial aid package that would help cover this. But if you find that your financial aid package as it's currently constituted is covering exactly what your costs are, and you are unable to earn more in the academic year or the summer to cover it, then the source that right now would be available would be student loans.
The next question was asked by Aditi Bomwick, Daniel Alve, and Albert Wayne. Aditi, if you're here, you were first. Okay. Since Aditi was the only one who voiced the preference to read it herself, I will read the question. In what ways are students benefiting from the HELSI, both in terms of the long-term and short-term?
So I'll go back and reiterate some of what I said in answer to the first question. For a number of students who will be paying the fee, they now will have less out-of-pocket expense. So let me take a concrete example. And as you said, you've been there only once, but let's say you did something as stupid as I did, and you fell and you sprained an ankle right now. So I'm going to use an ankle sprain as an example. If a student who's on the health insurance were to sprain an ankle, the cost to deal with that ankle sprain runs about $350. That's the x-ray, that's the medical visit, and that's the cost of the ankle brace. So that's the cost whether you're on health, your private insurance or the university health insurance. If I'm on the student health insurance, what I would pay to get my ankle looked at and treated would be $10, just a $10 copay, because everything else has already been paid for as part of my health insurance. If I'm an if I don't have my insurance, I'll use your example, we would be giving you a bill of $270 at the time that you walked into to Gannett. It's conceivable that bill would get paid by your insurance company, but it also may not, depending on what your deductible is and whether they would consider our providers in their network or out of their network, and so you would need to pay $270. Now, if you were to have the health fee, you would still have that $350 cost, but your cost would be $10. So that's one example of the benefit. An ankle sprain may be something that you could wait and go home and see your, if you happen to live in Portland or in Albany. But if you live in Florida, you can't wait till you need to be treated here. So there's a direct benefit in that way. And I would argue, you may disagree, but I would argue that our ability to maintain the level of staffing so that the wait times for therapists and the ability to get in to see our medical clinicians are not unreasonable is a benefit to the students. And that's where that funding stream is allowing us to keep the staffing at the level that it is.
Thank you.
On the next topic of past lack of transparency regarding the fee, we had questions from Joseph Geingrad and an anonymous individual who called themselves A.D. White. Is Joseph Weingrad here? The one about the transparency. Do you want me to read it? So your question was, why were students left in the dark about the fee, and why was the administration dishonest about where this money is really going?
So I'm going to take issue with the second question, because I don't know that we've been dishonest about it, so I'd like to have you explicate that a little bit better about what you mean by dishonest. Why were students left in the dark We have been working for over 20 years trying to figure out a sustainable financial model for college health campuses across the country and grappling with this. Many of our peers went to a healthy well before us, so this is not a new model. It would be a fair criticism, as it has been given, that we didn't bring students in from the ground floor in trying to solve this problem. We haven't done that historically in setting all of the budgets of the university, and that may be just where we have a philosophic difference. I think we did consult with students as we were trying to size the fee, because there are two different ways we could have put the fee in place. One is a fee and a percentage of the cost of visit, 10% cost, 20%, or what we chose to do, which was the copay, so that basically there was parity between our health insurance students and our non-health insurance. There, actually, we did consult with students, and their input was actually quite helpful to us. And we do have intent going forward of creating a student health fee advisory committee. We have a student insurance advisory committee, and have had one in place for well over 20 years that has student, faculty, and staff. And so they do help us make the constant balancing act about the cost of insurance and the benefits provided. And we would anticipate that same conversation about the health fee going forward. But the need for the fee, and would there be one, was just, as President Scorton mentioned last week, one of those decisions that I think ultimately the administration had to make. If you would tell me a little bit more about what you mean about dishonesty, because I don't see that we've been dishonest. I don't see that. I would agree with you, we have not been as detailed as we're trying to be right now. And all the information I'm giving you is actually online right now. You could go to the Cornell Caring Community website, and you'll find the examples I cited. You'll find the list. Should we have started with that information flow in the beginning? Hindsight would tell me probably yes. We were advised to think about it differently, and you know, there I would say we took the wrong advice. But okay. So the way so that's a difference of interpretation. That I'll take that as a fair comment. My view is it's the cost we had to maintain the services that you had. So that's how I was characterizing it. I understand how you characterize it. So I hear what you're saying. But it was not in any intent meant to obfuscate. And so I appreciate that's how it's been interpreted. And so right now we're trying to just peel back the layers as much as we possibly can so that you understand where the dollars are going.
Okay, so the next question was from Caro Ashar. Caro, are you here?
Oh, this is the question regarding austerity measures. Sure. So Caro's question was, when and how will the students find out how successfully this measure is going, the debt repayment, the expanded services, etc.?
I'm not sure I understand the phrase austerity measure, Caro. Can you help me there? I think that gets Carol into a broader conversation beyond just the health fee. And he is getting ready to share with the broader community actually a fairly detailed financial plan, trying again to peel back the layers of the university's finances that will happen, I believe. They're trying to set the date for when the town hall forum will be. But I think what that is referring to is the reality that university-wide, our budget is barely balanced, and at the center in Ithaca, it is not balanced. we happen to be part of the center, but it's broader than that. So there will be a tightening of the belt this year again for all the administrative units and the colleges. And that's what I think he was referring to with the austerity measure. There will be some budget reduction that will be occurring across all the colleges and all the administrative units. And at the same time, we are taking a look at a number of the administrative units in what, for lack of a better label right now, is being called an efficiency committee. How does IT get managed across all the colleges and all the administrative units? We don't have a single plan of providing dining services on campus. We have Cornell Dining, we have the hotel school, we have Gimme Coffee, we have Mandibles. You know, we're basically competing among ourselves to capture the market. So some of those are going to be some different ways to look at how we're spending. Gannett is part of that. It's an administrative unit. So as it is looked at, not on the clinical side, but things like, you know, communications, IT, HR, it gets the same analysis and expectation as other units. You know, as to the where the fee is going, that's what we're trying to say today, which is what I responded earlier about the split between the $200 and the $150 and what's in that $200.
Okay, our next question was from Carolina Bieri.
My name is Kalina. I am on the community of the FA and my company. I'm on the community of the FA. So you've been in concern over the community about the lack of accessibility to Gannett on the end and
so they are maybe at your committee's instigation, Matt, in the middle of that kind of analysis. So just let me say what hours they are open, and Sharon, if I get this wrong, correct me. But they are open for from 5 until 7 for consultation, particularly in the mental health area during the week. And they are open on Saturdays in terms of hours of Gannett. And of course, then they're available 24/7 on a crisis. So they do have what I'll call traditional office hours of the 8 to 5. Then they run the 5 to 7 for walk-in for some limited care. And then on Saturdays, they are open. They are not open later than 7, and they're not open on Sundays. We have certainly heard from students and parents there's an interest in trying to expand the hours. So the staff is at work right now to see basically two things. And one is, within the existing funding, including this health fee, is there a way to create a staffing plan that allows you to stretch the hours? And that's a one analysis. You know, are we finding that we have too many people in an 8 and you ought to be better off having them there till 6? You know, that's a it's a complicated one if you have families at home, but that's an analysis. The second then becomes, if there is such a demand to extend the hours, then at what cost? And does the fee bring us any additional revenue to cover that cost, or is that one of those questions that, as this health fee advisory committee gets put together in subsequent years, that's one of the trade-offs we're going to be seeking advice on? You know, do you have the fee increase? I'm going to make this number up because we don't have this plan. But would you have the fee increase to $375 or $400 because now you could hire the staff who wanted to work on Sunday? So they don't want to work during the week. They want to be home with their kids during the week, and now their partner is home on the weekend. They want to work on the weekend. But that's an additional staff person, and additional staff people cost more money. So I can't say definitively how they're looking at it, but I know as recently as yesterday, the staff was trying to spend some time seeing if there's some way to expand some of the staff in the projected funding stream that we have.
The next question was related to tuition. The questions were asked by Caro Akar and Kevin Howald. Caro, if you want to ask your question.
Uh, So the answer to that is yes, there will be a tuition increase, I am sure, as I sit here. President Gordon, as part of his discussion with the campus that I think will be coming in the next couple of weeks. And so I think that will, so a direct answer, no. The health fee will not be any of the increase. I fully expect that there will be a tuition increase in my 45 years associated with the university. I've never seen that there has not been one. In part because the biggest cost the university has is people. That's the largest cost of our faculty and staff. And there will be some increased costs, some of which is driven by union contracts that have been negotiated on a multi-year basis, and some because we will be paying our faculty and staff some additional funding. I will tell you that on housing and dining, there will not be a housing and dining increase next year. But that's a question that's really better addressed by President Gordon when he's doing the town hall meeting. Okay?
Max, did you want to make an announcement, or?
Yeah, I'm going to walk around with the mic.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The next question was asked, again, by several people. The question is related to, like, why the cost is going to students and whether there are any alternatives. The question was asked by James Castle, Nikki Moore, Carolyn, Anonymous, James Knight, Joseph Weingrad, Gabriella Knight, and Albert Wayne. The first person who expressed interest in voicing the question was Nikki Moore. Nikki, are you here? Second person was Carolyn. Third person was Joseph Weingrad. Sure.
Oh, which one is that? There were a lot of similar questions asked. So Joseph's question specifically was, why should this fee apply to students who choose not to use Gannett and seek off-campus medical care instead, especially since some private insurance will get better coverage off-campus?
So I think I addressed that earlier, but I'll just reiterate. It's not just for the individual services that are rendered for people seeking care. There is an aspect of what the staff at Gannett do to support the public health of the campus, and that's where part of the fee is going.
I actually think that's the end of our previously submitted online questions. We did have some. Should we read it now? All right, so we're just going to go straight into the audience questions. And if you want to ask questions after this, we have 5 audience questions right now. Please feel free to add your name or just stand up afterwards. The first audience question we have is actually from Joseph Weingren. Oh, he has a mic. Okay. Then the next person is Peter Biedenweg.
My question is related
to the debt. Okay.
I was wondering, once the debt is paid off, will there be a reduction in the fee cost? And a second part of that would be, what would be the consequences of reducing the fee right off the bat?
So in answer to the second part of your question, I think the consequences would be either we have to cut back on the access to services rather considerably, so you would end up having a fee increase with virtually no extra benefit. Or we would still be lacking the sufficient funding to maintain the level of staffing that we currently have. And as I said, that's, you know, we don't staff for the sake of staffing. We are constantly looking at the demand and looking at the wait times and trying to balance those out. When the debt is paid off, then we'll have to look at where are we in terms of the services that, that the campus is looking for, and do you maintain the fee to create some of those extra services. We will be in a new building by then. Although the building will be built by other funds, are there increased costs to maintain that building that will need to be taken care of in terms of how does the university budget model deal with the facility costs? Some of those are held centrally, some get pushed out to units, and so that, as our new budget model evolves, we'll need to understand what those costs are. So that, the debt, and I should know this, I'm not going to remember, that gets paid off, I don't think, until 6 or 7 years from now. So we'll have to see where we are at that point.
The next question was is from Gabriella Borges. Borges?
This is about something specific, but I was just wondering why students don't have like, right?
I can't tell you why it's that. Well, I think you'll find in the campus code there that you have a number of rights that are outlined. Freedom of assembly, freedom of expression, freedom from harassment, freedom from bigotry, freedom from discrimination. So there's a whole host of things that you are provided. I'm not sure what you mean or what you would want to include in a student's Bill of Rights. But there are lots of freedoms that you do have here on campus, and it may be that the way the campus code is written, we tell you when those get violated what the consequences are, but you can interpret it the other way in terms of what your freedom or what your rights are.
So there's actually a good essay represented meeting myself and some law students working on this right now. So if you're my identity is SCP-295, so I
can write it down for you. And I would
say, anything that you have, it's a very opportunity.
Yeah,
so
it'll be a little bit different,
kind of
probably.
Good to know. Thanks, Sarah. Next question was from Franklin Yang.
Okay.
My first question was, some of us believe that we may not be getting all the information. I personally don't believe it either. I was just at last week from practice and I was told to go home after an hour and I could not diagnose that. My second question was that some of us worry that the extension services and utilization services are poor and used by most of the same people.
So let me start with the first question. Obviously, it's not our expectation that the services that we provide aren't rising to your expectations. And so I would say two things. From an overall organization, Gannett is, by external measure, is one of the most highly regarded health services, and I don't just say that because I'm proud of it. We've gotten the Jed Seal from the Jed Foundation, which is one of the nation's leading foundations addressing mental health. There's something called the American Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, AAAHC, which is the accrediting body for units like Gannett. Gannett consistently gets the highest rating possible. And then just recently, maybe 2 years ago now, they were recognized as actually the only university in what's called a patient-centered medical home, which is basically a description of how it tries to integrate medical, mental, and health promotion services in an integrated way. So those are our expectations. That's what our external folks tell us. But it doesn't mean on an individual patient have an experience that's not to your liking. And it's very important for us to get that feedback, because we may have an individual problem with the provider, we may have a systemic problem we're not aware of. There is a patient advocate system within Gannett that we take very seriously. So I would encourage you, I'm happy to be able to pass that along to the patient advocate, if with your permission, have them reach out to you, Franklin, on your specific example. But I guess I would say to all of you, if the awareness of the patient advocacy is not well known, I would love your feedback about how can we get that out. Because if you have a concern, you need to know where you can make that concern. And so I want to make sure that the student body is aware of that. So that would address the first one. You know, on the second one, I think there's really an iteration of what we said before. Do you only have to pay because you're getting a direct service, or is there other benefits of having, you know, a top quality health center on a residentially based campus? And we believe that that's something that we need to be providing, you know, both for the public health that I described, and because, you know, and I think President Sorkin said this yesterday, we don't know when the next public health crisis is going to occur, and you can't staff at that level. So some of this is trying to make sure we have the staff in place that, you know, God forbid we have a SARS breakout or an H1N1 breakout, or, you know, as our colleagues right now at Tulane are grappling with a suicide cluster again. So it's not just the direct benefit. Is that the second question, or is there more that you want me to address in that? Okay. Right. So, you know, when you think about the training we do of faculty to notice and respond to students in distress, all the information you can access on the web, the work that we're doing around bystander intervention, sexual violence prevention, alcohol, are some of those examples where it's not a direct clinical provision, but it is affecting the life of the campus. And that's part of what we're paying for.
The next person on our list is Daniel. So.
Essentially, student assembly representatives were initially invited to the series of meetings where you were considering to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, the student body didn't hear about it at all. You didn't do a town hall like this. Like, no one had any idea that this is something that you were considering. From what I've heard, at a certain point, you stopped inviting student assembly representatives to these meetings. They didn't hear about it for some period of time, and then like found out about it like a few hours before you were going to the student assembly meeting. After it got out that the money wasn't actually going where you were saying it was going, and you know, you can say it's a misinterpretation, but I, you know, maybe not as many as believe that. But but so after it came out that it was actually going to these separate like the debt, for example, you backtracked and called it a misunderstanding while simultaneously pressuring student assembly representatives to actually withhold information from their constituencies and from inside sources that are trying to say. In some cases, actually writing emails for student assembly representatives to have done it. So the question is, like, what are you afraid of? Why would you do these things? Why aren't students included in decisions that affect us as a patient sign-up?
So let me first address the fact, and then I'll try to answer the last part of your question. It is true that we consulted with some student assembly representatives and some non-student assembly representatives. We invited small focus groups to come, as we had developed this healthy, that we had been working on it with an administrative problem we were trying to solve, which is how do we maintain the level of services that we believe are important, and what's the financial model we can put in place, while we're also trying to figure out this brand new budget model of the university. Once we had something that we felt like we could talk about, we started with a blank piece of paper, we held some focus groups which involved student assembly members to get some feedback. That's what I was saying earlier about should it be a 10%, $10 copay. I would agree with you. I think we ended up, in hindsight, putting the student assembly representatives in an awkward position, especially since they were legibly that they needed to keep that confidential even after it was out in the public. And you know, that's a relationship we have to repair with the student assembly, because I think we put them in almost like an untenable position. We actually thought, because of the focus groups, we sort of knew this could likely begin to spread, because there were, you know, we asked people to work with us, and we didn't sign it, had to sign a confidentiality statement, but we were still having a work in progress, and so we were asking them not to go put it on the front page of paper, because it might not turn out the way we were having the discussion. I think it did put elected representatives in a particularly difficult position. So one of the things that we've got to work with as the administration and the elected student body, we value the governance system, that's where we turn for advice and when we're trying ideas out. But if they're feeling that in their election they need to be entirely transparent at all times with their constituency, we sometimes are going to have some conflict there. And we've got to figure out together, the administration and the student assembly, how to build that relationship. We're not afraid of anything other than worst misinformation. Now, you may say we've created the worst misinformation imaginable by what we did, and I will accept that criticism. But there's a lot of stuff that as an administrator, when I'm dealing with, pick a budget, athletics budget, this health services budget, the dean of students budget, or whatever, that it's complicated, there's information that involves staff salaries and benefit plans, that some of the information is not appropriate for students to have, and in other cases, that's not why you're here. You're here to be students, to go to class, to learn, to get active. I'm here as an administrator to try to run organizations. And so it would be unfair to burden you with a full amount while I'm trying to figure out our budget issues. So sometimes, you know, we get it really wrong. As I said, I think we made a mistake here by going at a much too high level in our first announcement as opposed to the detail that we're going now. I take that as a completely fair criticism. We talked about it and internally chose to go a different path than we might have, and that turned out to be a mistake. But there will be things, I mean, that's in some ways why you have an administration, and we have to make some decisions about the running of, quote, the business of Cornell while you are learning and, you know, creating the vibrancy of student life. So we have different roles to play on the campus. And trying to find the right places for the intersection is a constant work in progress. If I were afraid, I wouldn't be here this afternoon trying to answer as many questions as I could.
Thank you. The next question is from Gabby Kaufman. Gabe Kaufman.
Gabe Kaufman. Hi, Gabe. The total amount that we had to borrow over the 2 years plus interest, I believe, is in excess of $4 million.
Okay.
The next person is Nadia Shibaro.
I guess if you're taking out a loan, I'm assuming that that means some way of improving
but then you have a revenue stream, so money is not being given to the students collateral for projects that you haven't yet mentioned. And I guess the other question is, when you talk about checking your note, I'm wondering why it isn't late. Employees and workers and staff that cross the border of building communities.
So let me try to go back and break down the fees, because the way you reflected what you thought I said is not what I meant to say. So I obviously wasn't understood. Two big fees. $150 is basically covering increased access to services in place of paying fee as you go. There's some staffing costs that are associated with that. $200 is covering the increased funding that we provided to Gannett when we expanded the staff in 2009 and 2010. So there's ongoing salary and benefit costs for that increased staff. And to maintain that level of staffing, after we lost our one-time fund, we had to borrow for 2 years in excess of about $4 million. So that $200 is covering a debt repayment, which is about $70, and the remaining $130 is for that increased staff that has been in place since 2009-2010. That we had one-time funds, we don't have those funds anymore. So $200, it's got two pieces to it, and $150. That should add up to the $350. The building itself, as I mentioned, is a $55 million building project. One-third came from philanthropy, one-third came from the colleges, and one-third came from the administration in terms of our budget. So none of this fee is going to that $55 million expansion. The last question that you asked gets right back into President Scorton's overall discussion about the priorities that the institution has made. We actually are at a point where right now our faculty is at an all-time high in the number of faculty. We've never had more faculty on the campus than we do now. Some of that's because we're doing some backfilling in anticipation of retirement and trying to have a smooth transition. It is true we've gone through a building phase. Some of that's paid for by the state. Any of the building that goes on in the contract colleges, like Stockton Hall, the Vet School, that's paid for by the state, not by private philanthropy at Cornell. But that's a much broader question that I would say, Park, excellent question, but they're going to be better handled by the president in his town hall than I can address, because I'm not involved in the individual decisions that a dean is making, for example, in the hotel school to expand faculty versus others. I just don't know the details of those conversations or how engineering is thinking about an expansion of facilities or renovation versus their faculty. But it's a very important question. Don't be sure of that. And you're not the only one who has to do it on campus. It's very fair.
Next question was from Yamini Bhandari.
My question is, you know, you kind of expressed the sense that we're also trying to be a little bit more transparent with student spending in that regard. But I'm wondering what measures, like, you know, have in mind to, I guess, like, really go forward with that idea of being transparent, especially with student spending.
Well, I have some ideas, you know, whether they get taken up, it's not clear to me because I won't be here after June 30th, as you know. I would hope, quite frankly, that we find that the presentation that President Scorton will be doing this spring and the discussion that we'll have is not a one-time event. We can go back many years ago. I've been here long enough that I can think of the days when we used to do a budget hearing in the fall before we went to the trustees with discussions around tuition, room, and board. That would try to outline some of the trade-offs and the discussions that were happening. When we were in crisis, it had a lot of attendance, and things were not in crisis. You know, you had the budget director talking to about three people. And then I think we got lazy and didn't continue that. I think there's
if I had my personal druthers, I would leave for a day. I would find a way to try to have a budget discussion with the shared governance groups every fall, as one example. I think as we're looking at things that particularly involve students, we need to find some better ways than we seem to have found. I mean, we have some of those mechanisms in the Residents and Community Life Committee of the Student Assembly, and then the work that's going on in the Grad and Professional Student Assembly, as we think about housing and dining in particular. But I think over the years, on some of the budget side, we've not been, frankly, quite as transparent as we might have. So I would hope that, and I don't know what President Garrett's style will be or what her experience has been at USC in that domain. But that would be a piece of advice I would give to my professor.
After the Q&A ends at 6:05, we do have the open forum where people can continue to make comments and questions. The list for that is now open, so if you want to make a comment or a question for the forum afterward, please head there. The next person on the speaker list is Blake Brown.
In the past week, since the student health team has been announced, I think it's provoked a lot of anger, but it's also provoked really productive discussions about financial transparency in particular. I've received this issue. I think if the President's Court had written an email, if he included a link to an income statement or a balance sheet, not even a super detailed one, but just with some numbers that students could look at, to feel more assured that we're aware of the financial state of our university and that we have some input in it. I think that would go a long way, and I think students would have been a bit more understanding of the need. So I'm just wondering, going forward, do you have any plans, any mechanisms to just be more transparent with university finances? Thank you.
So there is, I believe, There are a couple of documents that actually exist out there about the finances, so I'll give you a couple of examples. Within my own division, we have an annual report. It's up on the web, available in my office, and you will see in that report an income and expense statement. And that's something we've made available since I've been vice president. The financial statement of the university is a public document. So that is out there. It's written in financial statement ease. So some people find it readily accessible and some people find it less than readily accessible. But you could go on the web right now under the Division of Finance and find the university's official audited financial statement. There also, I believe, and I will confirm this with Sarah, but I believe there are publications that come out, and this would be after the board, so this would not necessarily address what are we doing beforehand, but afterward, that's called the budget documents, that are public documents once the board has approved it. Now, my personal feeling is it's not for lack of information, it's for lack of making information accessible and understandable and timely. And I think there we have not done as well as we could, and I think that's where we need to figure out a different pattern. I think some of all of what you asked you could have gotten on the web. Was it linked from this? No. And so
the next question is from Stephen Masterson.
My question pertains to a previous question from the front row. He asked what to do with around how you get paid to use your private insurance plan, and he never showed it yet. So your answer had to do with taking out a loan. I can think of several situations where maybe one gets denied, or maybe it's just for a financial decision. You're getting a thought on how much one of the costs you're on a tight budget, and it's just going to take out. Is there another option?
At this point, we do not have another path. And I think we will have to see whether we end up with students who really have no place to turn. That is not our expectation. given that the, but I think, so the most straightforward answer I can give you at this point is beyond the loan or beyond incorporating it into how you are using the allocation of your financial aid for personal expenses and how this makes it into that, we don't have another path at this stage. I understand that's a harsh answer, but I'm trying to be as honest as I can.
The next person is Philip Tacombe.
Hi, so I currently serve on student assembly as an LGBTQ at-large. So currently, according to first audit report on campus, LGBTQ people are subjected to the most valuable group per capita out of all organizations on campus. Because of this, as well as I feel undergraduate and social background, LGBTQ people are most likely to need additional counseling, psychological services, and any other group. I've been subjected to a bathroom to last year myself. The waiting time was 3 weeks for an appointment, but because I was considered an expedited case, because I was physically beaten on the state of our LGBTQ, I was given a waiting time of 2 weeks. So because of this, I obviously pushed my psychological services, as well as many the other people in my constituency has had to do. So therefore, I'm just wondering what you might be saying in terms of, I know you talked about accessibility and increasing services. I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit more about that in terms of counseling and psychological services.
So within CAST, we do a variety of things. So we do triage urgency of cases, urgent, immediate, less urgent. And every case that comes, and I would hope this happened to you, if it didn't, I need to know about that, there is a phone triage. So you call in within 24 hours, you have a phone call back. So if it's the most urgent, people get walked in, we have staff who are available right then and there. And there are some students who we do that, and we have to do that because they are in such a fragile state. Others, they will call, and within 24 hours, there is an assessment made, and then the path is established. One of the reasons we have Let's Talk out across the campus is just trying to provide walk-in service in addition to what we have at Gannett. It's also, which would not be necessarily right in your particular situation at that moment, one of the reasons we are also growing group sessions, because there's some folks who at a point in their, either the issues they're dealing with or their own recovery, moving from individual to group is actually a better thing. So what we're trying to do is create this range of services that are available and target them to the, if you will, the level of need. Your professional level of need and ours don't always align. And I would say if there's a negative impact on that, we need to take a look at it in a bit more, and we'll spend some time talking with Brian if this seems to be a systemic issue within a particular community. I hear you asking the question not just within the LGBT community, but the broader issue. For some people who want to have access to counseling support, although it may seem like forever in the world of a student, a two-week wait time is not unusual. And I can tell you in a number of places off campus, you know, it sometimes can take you a month to get in to see a therapist. So if you got in less than 2 weeks, you were very lucky. But it's an issue we are constantly looking at. And as we look at our mental health demand, and you will see that on the information we just posted with what the demand is and what our staffing levels are, you know, we're trying to be at this balancing act of not overstaffing, because we don't want to pay too much, it's not being used, but when are we at a point that we need to increase the staffing because that demand is getting to a point that we need to grow the hours or grow the people.
I think the next question will probably be our last. The next person on the list is Alex Klein.
Matt, she's right up here.
And I might just add in response to the last question, if you've not had a conversation with Greg Teal, head of counseling and psych services, I'd love to try to put the two of you guys together. Okay? Greg Teal, E-E-L-L-S, director of counseling and psych services.
Yes, Al.
So one of the reasons we use deductive identity is compared to the app for normal terms for driving for 1 year. And the two areas of driving are the
I'm sorry, Al, I'm having a hard time hearing you. So could you maybe stand up?
One of the reasons justified state is in comparison to Cornell, quote unquote, out of one period, and that's in the caring community, as I mentioned earlier. People look at free bus passes, free gym memberships, and they have two wizards. The students have everything from jobs to justice state that they're those students, for example, at 12 University. Why are we only similar to our peers in our political media?
I think we try to cite benchmark examples in a whole variety of areas. I do, we do it on tuition levels, that's part of the public information. We do it on room and board levels. We do it on debt and endowment for students. We do it in particular fees. So I don't, I don't take that we use benchmark information for our peers when it's politically convenient. We try to do it on a whole host of issues. One of the reasons we do not have some of the same financial benefits as our peers, quite frankly, is we are a much poorer institution. Now, it's hard for me to describe Cornell poor when I say that we have an endowment in excess of $5 billion. But if you look at the endowment per student at Cornell, it is 1/20th of what Princeton is, and one, that's probably an overstatement, but it's a huge difference. The size of our student body, the financial need of our student body, the breadth of this, the size of this overall campus is such that we are trying to compete on financial aid, on faculty salaries, on programs with tuition levels that are not twice what everybody else's are, because that would price us out of the market. But we do not have the income from endowment. And we are just beginning to get the gift income from our alumni at a comparable level of our peers. So it does have us in the situation of trying to provide you a comparable education, but having to look at current revenue streams to pay for that. So that's why you have some differences. But I just personally would have to say I don't think we compare ourseles to our peers only when it's going to be convenient. We're doing that all the time. We don't always come up favorably, I'll grant you that, but we know that.
So we did have three more people on the list. Would you mind finishing up that list? Or?
I'm happy to do it.
Okay, thank you. So the next person on the list is Mana Chak. Chak?
Exactly how we describe where the, what the revenue stream is and the expense going out, we can do that in broad categories. What's going in the salary and benefit area? What's going into equipment, and purchases? Whether we'll ever be able to tie $25 of this is gotten you 4 extra hours there, I think that's unlikely. But we'll try to figure out ways that say, as the revenue has come, what are the services that we're able to offer that we could not do before, as an example. And that may be an area where the Health Fee Advisory Committee that we're going to set up can help us of how to translate the information we have into helpful information for students so that the kinds of questions that you have we are addressing. And toward that end, I might just say, as I mentioned, virtually everything I've shared with you is now out on the Caring Community. We put together a Health Fee page off the Caring Community website. I would encourage you to go to that website, and if there are additional questions that you have or information you would like, I invite you to write me at FHM1, and that may be where we'll continue to expand. We have a whole series of FAQs. And so if there are other questions we ought to be adding to that, please let me know.
The next speaker is Max Weisbrod.
They're in fact very separate. The budget of New York Tech is a separate budget, and it has its own fundraising set of goals. The initial gift that we received of $350 million from Chuck Feeney gave us the funding to start the staffing, as well as build the first academic building. And they have been in fundraising mode since. You just heard, I think, recently a significant gift from Verizon Corporation for the Exec Edge. So the pressure that we're feeling here on the Ithaca campus is distinct. It's almost like a firewall between, just as there is between the medical college and the Ithaca budget. They're two separate budgets. That would be the same in terms of the tech. But again, Max, that would be, you know, President Scorton is, because he's president of the whole university, I worry about student academic services here on campus. That would be a question I would really encourage you when he has the town hall to talk about. So I think, again, it's one of those questions like, why buildings as opposed to people, that you're not the only one asking it, and I'm giving what I know about it from where I sit, but that would be an excellent question to ask him.
Joseph Friedman.
Hi.
Hi.
So that's where some of the extra funding will go.
You'll see this on the web. Okay.
Now, this shows you what has been the professional staff in counseling and psych services. Just so I know we talked about this last week, but just for the benefit of others. Let's start in 2000. Just so we'll start with this decade. There were almost 15 professional staff in counseling and psych services in the year 2000. In 2014, there are over 30 staff. So we have more than doubled the staff, and you can see the student utilization. You know, it's a little bit like, if we build it, they will come. They're coming, we need to build it. So, I'm concerned that I'm hearing from several of you that there's a longer waiting than I believe we would be anticipating. So that's why I need to go talk with Greg as well. There will be some who would like to see a counselor for whom the issue is not urgent. And so that may be a 2 to 3 week time frame. And I don't even like to have that, but I understand why we're doing it. As I said, that's one of the reasons why we try to make Let's Talk available across the campus, where you can just walk in, no appointment, have an initial conversation. For some students, that's what all they need at that point, and they're comfortable waiting. So again, if that service is not being utilized enough, we need to get some advice from you about how we make sure that that's known. But I will follow up with Greg, because I don't think we would be anticipating from what I'm inferring, it's not atypical for a 3 week plus waiting time, and that's not what I'm hearing internally. So I need to figure that out.
Sure. We know that there are going to be a lot more
Not at that rate, no. But there is growth built into the budget, Josh, for staff. Absolutely. That's a lot where that 150 expansion of services is. We have a fairly sophisticated modeling that looks at the utilization of Gannett for those who are on student health insurance. There is a differential utilization of those who are on the prepaid versus not. And so we are expecting that with the fee, there will be some increased demand. We don't expect that we'll necessarily completely match, but that's the modeling we've done to then set the level of fee to allow us to staff behind it.
Okay, so unfortunately we had two more people on the list, but to keep the FAA meeting, especially after this forum moving, we're just going to move on.
And if they would like to write me at FHM1 with their questions, please do so, and I'll do my best to answer them.
We'd really like to thank Vice President Murphy for the Student Assembly and for the community for coming here and trying to learn more about what this fee is about. The next thing we're going to do is go into a forum, but first I'd like to thank Susan Murphy for coming here.
Thank you for moderating.
So guys, now it's just going to be more of an open forum, just a broader discussion between students who came here, want to talk more about the issue, maybe even talk about the resolution that's on the table. It's really open to you, and the speaking time will stay the same at 1 minute. So is there a list in the back? Oh, which one? Oh, okay. Okay, so the first person on the list will be Joseph Friedman.
Yes, so I'd like to frame a bit of my comment with one of the questions that was asked, which was about why do we only compare ourselves to other IB's normalized practices when it's politically convenient on an administrative level rather than on a student-driven level. And I'd just like to open up this forum with a question, which is the last time that you saw a meaningful contribution occur because of student assembly advocacy despite opposition. When's the last time that you felt that was represented? And I want you to ask yourself, if that hasn't happened, why do you think that happened? Thanks.
The next person on the list is Alex Vermillion. Oh, okay. Okay. Is there anyone else? Is there anyone else who would wish to speak? There? Oh,
I think we have three.
Okay. You? Okay.
So I just think that this resolution is not a very good one because it's under recommendation, and the FAA clearly has the inability to exert its power over the administration or any of the decisions. So it's kind of that they're doing this. It just seems like
would like to see?
Just to follow up on that, did y'all catch the moment where she said that the reason that you weren't included in the administrative position is because they were afraid that you were going to leave, like,
the only way that they can possibly shove every single cost that they have down the student worker's throat is by not involving us in the decision. It's painful.
Oh, was there someone there who wanted to speak? No? Yeah, you guys can also sign up in the back. Oh, we're clear? Okay. Did Yamini, did you have a hand up? Next person is Zakia.
Yeah, so I don't know if some of you guys have been paying any sort of attention to university that's happening and universities or colleges around the world, particularly Chile. I'm pretty sure they kind of just, have been doing something over the last couple of years to get the same sort of thing that a lot of people want to have to do with universities. So I think it's kind of really important for us to keep in mind that the way that universities run, the way that universities and colleges are run in America are not the only way that they can function. And that actions like what they did on Monday can happen more frequently if we are more involved in taking action and take control of the university. And we take control of our education. And heck, we're paying like hundreds of thousands of dollars to attend the university. I don't know about you, but I think if I'm going to get that amount of money, do something, I'm just pretty sure that I'm having to stay involved in what happens with that money.
The next person will be him and Kushagra. Did you want to? So after him, Kushagra.
A couple of questions ago, people were mentioning, kind of back to back, the fact that, no answers were given really as to, why we weren't given the full financial transparency from the get-go. And I just want to consider for us, for the sake of our common sense, the fact that she mentioned that the information was there, it's not that it didn't exist, but that it was inaccessible. And I just want to consider, does that make it okay?
And then Kushagra?
I think that why we have these concerns about the issue is very important that we respect both the president and the university. A few days ago, I knew the president was going to the president and I asked the comments that he made that Kalamaka is a great university for
Emma Johnson also had her name on the other list. I was wondering if she would also like to speak.
So she kind of gave me a shout out to the community that I wanted to do something in the community. I guess the only question I have, I kind of like tore my heart and soul into the community, it was a really big moment out. But the only thing that I find particularly discouraging about this is that people come up to me and they're like, I'm on a mission, like, I'm going to put in like, things that are like pretty necessary to be able to like healthy, happy, safe. And I set up a meeting for a lot of administrators and I talked to them and they basically tell me that the funds are dried up and we don't have money to do these things. So like it's really hard to continue to support my garden in this thing when I set up a meeting and I'm constantly like hitting a wall. I don't know if I can develop the priorities of our funding.
The next person is Joseph Friedman. Connor?
I'm going to go to the next one. I know the question that you've been building often, and let me ask about that question because you've not seen the short benefit, specifically if you look at the net as a building that may expand it. Like, if the current demand is good enough according to them, and it was able to accommodate extra staff members, why are they expanding it, and why are we being told that we're not there? It's kind of up there to keep on building new buildings. I think it's really, like, they say that private donations to the university that they're not responsible for them, but they do have something in priority. And they go out there and tell different men what they want their donations to go towards. And so if we don't need it, and they're expanding that, why don't they fundraise for these things? And I think that the earlier there before I mentioned the benchmark and the best practices of other Ivy League, we can be more pushing in terms of our financial aid is one of the worst compared to the rest of the Ivy League, and so are the costs that we have to get into the CS dimension. I think there's a lot of ways to use for the attracting those issues.
All right, so technically it's 6:30, and I know I'm going to give it to Sarah.
So. Hi, guys. Technically, our meeting due at 6:30. I do want to give you guys an opportunity to speak for a little bit longer if you'd like to stay. If you'd like to stay. The only problem is there is going to be a visual in here in a few minutes for the Capitol victim, and I do want to be respectful to people who are organizing that visual. It starts at 7:15, and I'm not going to ask that we motion to extend the meeting, but I will say that we can continue to discuss the open microphone until about 6:50 for whoever would like to stay, and then we can start to leave after that and people can come in and set up. Is that kind of fair to everyone?
Does anyone want to say something? It doesn't seem like it. I'll turn it over back to Sarah if no one has anything to say.
If there's nothing that anyone would like to say,
I think Joseph has something.
A lot of people turned up. No one turned up because they have a massive appreciation beyond it in our next generation. They open microphones every single week. When you say no, no, that's just say it. Because of legislation, please do show up.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.